Welcome. You're listening to the Brainy Speech Therapist podcast. Here we explore all things related to brain injury with a focus on the role of speech and language therapy within this exciting and ever-changing area. We're your hosts, Helen McLean and Jan McIntosh Brown.
And thanks for joining us tonight for our episode on Focus on the Family. We've got a really fantastic chat coming up. But first, personally, I want to talk about some things that I've learned so far. First, having listened to our first episode, we were all aware that there was a bit of a difference in our volumes. We are recording in different locations due to restrictions, so we do apologise for the different sort of sound qualities. We are working on getting better with our volume, so you know, please hang in there and let us know what you think. Also, just on a wee personal note, I mentioned that I moved over here with my family, but it wasn't my whole family. I left my two older sons are still living in Australia, so g'day from Scotland, boys. And finally, I mentioned a condition called hyperacusis, which is hearing sensitivity, and I suggested an easy sort of strategy to try. But really, if you do think you've got hyperacusis, it's best to see a specialist, and that would be an audiologist. So Helen, we might actually try and get someone to come and chat with us about that in the future.
I think that would be a really interesting conversation to have, yeah.
Yeah, we had someone talk to us about it, very researchy, but I have worked with a guy in Edinburgh who actually does the assessments, so we can have I'll see if I can track him down.
That would be great.
Anyway, thanks everyone for listening to me and all the things that I'm trying to learn and grow to help become a great clinician. So Helen's going to tell us a little bit about the person, our mystery person who's come to have a chat with us tonight. But before that, here's a short message.
The opinions and views expressed in this podcast are of the individual and should not be considered professional advice. If you have a brain injury, suspect you have a brain injury, or think someone you know has a brain injury, please seek dedicated professional advice.
So, hi, I'm delighted to introduce my friend and colleague, Lynn Grayson, to the podcast as our very first guest. Lynn has worked as a speech and language therapist for over 20 years, specialising in brain injury rehabilitation. She has also taught on the speech and language therapy degree course at the University of Strathclyde here in Scotland. And then towards the end of 2017, she began her research into the needs of communication partners following traumatic brain injury. This year, at the time of recording, we're in 2020, she published the first paper resulting from this research. A link is in the show description for this episode, and we've also put a link out in our social media channels a few days ago. Hopefully some of you have had a chance to read this. Lynn, I know how busy you are, so we are so, so grateful you've managed to find a window for this chat. I know that's a bit of a quick bit of background information on you. Is there anything else that you'd like to add to that?
Well, it's very exciting to be here, and I feel very old hearing you describe me there. I've been working as a speech and language therapist for about 24 years, and my main role has been brain injury, but sort of at different stages of the journey. So I started in acute hospital care in Scotland and then Australia, and then I moved to working with intensive rehab units in London and then Scotland. And now finally, I've been working in community services with the lovely Helen. So that's been wonderful.
I did not know you worked in Australia.
Yeah, just for a short period.
Wow.
It was great. Loved it.
Interesting, the things you learn about people on this podcast.
I'm the odd one out here with no Australia connection. Oh, well, maybe one day.
All right, we'll have to get you over there.
So, Lynn, you're here to talk to us about your paper, which published earlier this year, entitled A Survey of Cognitive Communication Difficulties Following TBI. Are families receiving the training and support they need? I think to start with, it would be good to go back to the beginning. What was your initial motivation for beginning this research journey?
Well, that's a really good question. So I would say the community team that I work for started off very small, but over the years we've actually grown in size quite considerably. So in the beginning, we only really had the manpower to focus on the person following brain injury and nothing else. But as we've grown, I've become interested in developing our service to include the needs of families following brain injury as well, so that we can extend the service and actually support more people. So that was where my focus came from.
And did you find that in terms of a research topic, had that formulated itself for you quite quickly and quite easily, or did it change a lot in the early days?
Well, to make anybody feel better about maybe thinking about research in the future, I have to say that I was completely clueless at the beginning, and actually quite low in confidence about what it was I was going to do. But luckily, I found some excellent research supervisors to help me. And they were wonderful because they managed to narrow down all my big, crazy ideas into something that was workable. And it was actually a project that we could do and get some, you know, relevant information from. So I want to have a big shout out to my supervisors, Professor Marion Brady and Dr. Maizun Ali, who are at Glasgow Caledonian University NMAP unit, and then also Professor Leanne Tor from the University of Sydney. So I wouldn't have been able to produce any of it without them.
But you're quite networked, Lynn.
Yeah, well, you know, that's it. When you're scared and don't know what you're doing, that's the first thing that a speech and language therapist does. Reaches out and says, please help me. I've always been good at that.
And I think that's really encouraging to all of us, because we lack a little bit of confidence and it is a bit scary. So to hear that you've actually pushed through it, then we can do it too. Lynn, there's a really great statement that as soon as I read your article, I went, that is fantastic. I've read lots of articles on CogCom and I thought, I love what you did with this. So do you mind
Go for it. Go for it.
All right. Okay. I might need help with
the word. Oh, dear. Right. Hopefully I'll know it.
Yep. Yes. It's multi-syllable. Oh, yeah. You know it. Okay. The clinical presentation of a person with a cognitive communication difficulty is highly
heterogeneous.
Heterogeneous. Thank you. I just can't get my mouth around all those syllables. Okay. And can include difficulties with information processing, which is understanding implied, abstract and more complex content. Discourse, which is problems with quantity, quality, relevance, and cohesion of conversation. And social communication, which is difficulties recognizing verbal and nonverbal cues, initiating, maintaining and repairing conversation. I just really, really loved that statement. I think it's nice and clear and concise and sums it all up. Really,
oh, that's
really
nice.
Well.
I'm not sure how concise it is. I do apologise for my very long sentence.
No, I think it is a long sentence, but you know, there is the brackets that sort of explains each of the concepts. But I just thought, no, I really, really liked it. So, and I know a lot of people are probably wondering, you know, why the focus on TBI as opposed to brain injury just as a thing, you know. Have you got anything to say on that?
Yes, that was really difficult for us when we were trying to design it, but it was more just in terms of being able to get the people that have cognitive communication difficulties and traumatic brain injury to reply. So we had to sort of narrow it down to traumatic brain injury. So traumatic brain injury involves a bump, a blow or a jolt to the head that affects normal function.
Right.
And examples can be like a fall or a car crash. And the nature of this brain injury means that it's likely that a number of areas of the brain have been affected at the same time. So the communication changes are not just related to the damage of the language areas of the brain, but actually more likely to be affected by lots of things like attention, memory, fatigue, planning and organising, and awareness. And in order to try and capture that and differentiate it for patients that have perhaps had a stroke and where the damage might be in just one specific area, like the language area of the brain, we had to narrow it down to traumatic brain injury. But it's not to say that other acquired brain injuries don't have cognitive communication difficulties.
Yeah, because it's being used a bit more wider now, isn't it? I mean, I know I did training in 2012 and it was COGCOM and TBI, but now I hear it being used.
Yep, so people
widely.
With encephalitis or meningitis, also people that perhaps have had a heart attack and lack of oxygen to the brain, and aneurysms, and also some strokes as well. Cognitive communication difficulties can affect all of those things, but it was purely for the nature of doing the research that we had to narrow it down to traumatic brain injury.
Yeah. And then, so how do these cognitive communication difficulties impact on people with TBI?
So it has a really big impact on the person following TBI, depending on how severe their damage is. So for the person that's had a moderate or a severe brain injury, it can cause quite long-term difficulties in a number of areas of their life. So research has shown that it can affect relationships over the longer term. It can affect the person's ability to take part in social activities, ability to keep up family roles, ability to return to employment, and also keep up hobbies. And because of all these changes, it actually affects the person psychologically. So they can feel a bit low in mood or become anxious or feel a bit lonely. So it has quite a big ripple effect on the person over the longer term.
So it stands to reason that support for the families is so important.
Absolutely, because communication is not just a singular activity. Where it's sort of a team sport and we're all in it together. And it stands to reason if one person has had a change to their communication abilities, it will affect the whole family. And it'll affect, you know, the roles and the interaction and what happens within that family as a whole.
Yeah.
And so, Lynn, can I ask, with your research, did you find that families are getting the support that they need?
Yes, well, that's what I wanted to find out, because there's lots of research out there that has explored family needs for brain injury in general. And the clear picture that's coming through in a number of different countries over a number of different years is that family members are not feeling that they're getting their needs met in terms of information, training and support in general. But what no one had done was investigate whether they felt that they were getting their needs met in terms of communication. Were they understanding cognitive communication difficulties? Were they getting training for that? And were they being supported? And I think it's really difficult for clinicians at the moment to be able to deliver all of that because of time constraints and just difficulties in order to deliver, and also because the person following brain injury and the family member, their awareness of their difficulties and insight varies over time. And what we were finding in the community team is that we discharged people perhaps too soon before they developed full awareness into the impact of the cognitive communication difficulties. So it's almost about trying to catch people at the right time and deliver something that's for them and helps them, and bespoke. And I wasn't sure whether that was really happening, which is why I wanted to find out from families what they thought, because, you know, they're the experts in how they feel about this, so we need to get their opinions.
And so in terms of then taking that notion and building it into kind of a hypothesis for your research, and then building on that into kind of research and design and methods, could you talk through a little bit about those aspects?
Yeah, so in terms of what we did was we designed a questionnaire that had 32 questions about what families feel their needs are in relation to communication changes following brain injury. So we wanted to know what needs were important for them, what information was important, what training and what support, but also we wanted to know whether they felt that they'd received that information, whether they'd just received the training, and whether they'd received the support. And then there was one open question, so they were all closed questions, and then there was one open question at the bottom that said, how can we improve? What is it that is important to you that we're not doing, so that we could actually get some more information specifically from the families.
And were there things that came through in that surprised you?
Yes, lots of things came through. I was really fascinated by all of the answers. So first of all, families feel that the area of communication is really important to them. So over 70% of the 102 respondents said, yep, it's very important, this area, to us for information, training and support. And then the top eight needs that came up, it was over 90% of the people that responded said that they were very important. So what's that? It's good in terms of speech and language therapists. That means that, oh well, we're on the right track. They do want us, and they do want help with this. So then we just need to find out what it is that would be helpful.
And I think, we have a couple of packages that we can use for supporting families with communication. But I think, like you were saying, Lynn, is that it's actually quite bespoke, isn't it? It's like meeting that family with their need right there and then, working out how to support them with their communication with their family
And
member.
I think what the results were coming through was that it's not just in the first year following brain injury that, there was lots of family members 2 years post-injury or 3 years post-injury that were saying, no, we still have needs, we need help in how to deal with this. And it's only perhaps once the person's got home and been living at home for quite a long time that families are thinking, actually, I don't feel okay with this. I feel like I need a bit of support and a bit of help. And that's where the problem lies, because all the services for brain injury can often be quite front loaded, and they might have been discharged and then they're sort of left with no information. And a big key thing was that, they need written information, because often we are very good at providing, things verbally and explaining things to them verbally, but that's no use 2 years down the line when actually no one's around to help and they've not got that written information to turn back to go, oh yeah, that's what we were talking about. Those are what.
And when people are stressed, they're not oft always going to take in and keep that information. Can I ask you, Lynn, how did you manage to recruit the participants? Did you use your service most,
Well,
or
that's what
is this
this
just
was a big
UK?
learning curve for me as well. So, and this is where you do have to reach out and basically use everybody that you know to try and help. So thank you, everybody that helped. I advertised it online, and I did that through brain injury centres across the UK and Australia. And also I did it on Facebook and Twitter, and
I didn't
So
know
trying to
that.
get just everyone involved. But I also did it through paper copies as well, and I wrote to speech and language therapists all over the UK with some paper copies, asking if they could then distribute it to family members that it would be relevant for, and then I put a stamped addressed envelope in for them to return it. But because it was anonymous,
Amazing.
and I didn't want to know the people, it had to be anonymous. It was quite difficult, because then I couldn't really send follow-up requests for and reminders and things, because I
Reminders
didn't know
and
who the people were. It was really up to other parties to then pass it on. But Headway were fantastic, the brain injury charity, at passing it on to their
brilliant.
members. And brain injury centres like Hunter Coleman Burt were really good at supporting me. So thank you so much, everyone, for getting the message out there. And we only really had 10 weeks as well, which is not a long time.
And sometimes this short time frame, though, keeps it current, doesn't it? People can put things on a side and then it
But
gets
I had to put my
lost.
shyness to the side, really, and I basically had to harass people every week going, hello, it's me again. Have you given out any questionnaires? It would be fabulous if you did. And that's sort of against my nature, so I did find the promoting of it quite difficult.
Oh, well, good on you. Thank you so much for
Yeah,
doing it. Yeah,
what
Helen,
you
sorry.
you were saying a few moments ago about just that thing of interviewing people and getting information from people maybe a couple of years down the line. And I think you mentioned it in the final paper about just that kind of chronic nature of brain injury. And I think, would you agree that there's maybe needing to be a wee bit of reframing of how we view brain injury, that it's not a kind of time limited impact?
You go, Helen.
Absolutely. I think, you know, people have information training and support needs at different stages in the brain injury journey. Uh-huh. And that's where the future research needs to lie, really. It's like, what information do people need in the initial stages, as opposed to maybe 1 or 2 years down the line, as opposed to further down the line, where people are perhaps experiencing new roles or trying new things. It doesn't say that the cognitive communication problem is going to have disappeared or gone away by that stage. There might also be useful strategies that people need at that time.
It's that uh-huh. living well with a brain injury, isn't
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And did you find that people were kind of saying that they're, in terms of their training needs, that they were being met, or was it variable?
So what we found was that out of information training and support, information in terms of speech and language therapists, I think we're better at perhaps providing information than maybe perhaps getting everybody trained up in terms of communication partner training. It was found that perhaps training in terms of how to support someone in relationships and how to support someone to maintain social participation over the longer term, family members were feeling that perhaps it would be really good if we could do some more work in those areas. So that was a really useful finding for us, because we need to then perhaps think more about establishing those as specific goals right at the beginning. Because families were saying that they want to know about the long-term effects of cognitive communication difficulties. They want to be in the know. And we've got the research there that's showing us that people with cognitive communication difficulties over the longer term are struggling to maintain social participation with friends and family. They're struggling, you know, to maintain relationships. So we know that that's the research. The family want to know that. And then they want to know in terms of goals of how they can help specifically support the person following brain injury to sustain these roles as much as possible and sustain social participation as much as possible. So it was really helpful in terms of, as a clinician, thinking, right, what are my goals for cognitive communication difficulties? Am I actually including the family in them? Am I thinking about the long-term effects, or are we just thinking kind of short-term? And I think that's the big message from the whole of the research, is that it's not about thinking of short-term quick fix goals. It's about thinking about, like you were saying, living well with cognitive communication difficulties after a brain injury, and the person, the family member, feeling able and confident to support the person to achieve as much as possible.
And right at the start, Lynn, you were talking about, you know, that support for relationships and social participation. I mean, that's scary. That's right on the edge, isn't it, of where we sort of link with other disciplines and things. So, you know, I guess that's a challenge for us, isn't it, to sort of make sure we're linking in.
It's not something for speech and language therapists to take on alone. I think it's also to think about working alongside psychology and social work and occupational therapy and delivering, you know, support with a multidisciplinary team. But it's what's,
and I suppose then for people who are maybe not lucky enough to be in the same situation as the three of us who do work as part of multidisciplinary teams, maybe if you're out there and you're a speech therapist working on your own and you find it a bit difficult to link in with your occupational therapy colleagues or your psychology colleagues, hopefully this can maybe bolster you a bit to feel a bit more empowered to reach out to them and to understand that it is going to be helpful for the person that you're working with, won't it?
Indeed. And you know, because we were talking about brain injury, cognitive communication is obviously going to be quite a frequently occurring topic, so we do want to hear from more people working in this area, and we'll also keep talking about different resources and things you can use. So Lynn, in terms of, you know, coming sort of to the sort of discussion part of things, and what do people feel that, what do families feel would help them, you know, is it what sort of, did you get any insights to what they would have liked at the beginning, what they'd like later on?
People were quite clear about written information. People really want
Handouts.
I think more kind of bespoke information specific to that person, you know, what specifically has happened to their loved one in terms of the brain and also in terms of, you know, the cognitive communication changes and then also specifically how they can help. But instead of us just giving that information verbally, also having that written down. They were quite keen as well that there was maybe some online resources for people, interactive resources, you know, where, you know, I think COVID's been great for one thing, that, you know, we're actually all much better with computers and online and webinars and all sorts of things. So, you know, we need to develop our online resources for people so that if you know, they're at home, they don't know who to go to, they can look online and perhaps there'll be information about cognitive communication difficulty and how to support that online. They were looking for. They were also saying that, you know, follow-up appointments would be really useful because I think in the UK stroke patients get a follow-up at a year with their GP, and that doesn't necessarily happen with brain injury. And I think perhaps we discharge people and then there's not really a kind of review or a follow-up, so even though new issues might arise or the person might be considering new life roles that they might need support with, there's not necessarily in terms of our current service provision that ability for people to, you know, get a review appointment to see how it's going.
And when you think about, you know, the depth of the difficulty cognitive communication difficulties presents with, you would think a year after the injury you're just scraping the surface.
People talked as well about it would be really useful for some counselling services, perhaps to be for the person following brain injury to be offered counselling, but then also perhaps for family counselling to happen as well, not necessarily right at the beginning, but again a wee bit further down the line when people are at home and things have settled. Counselling came up quite a lot, particularly in the open question for things that would be useful. Other people said, you know, more information about this at different times through the journey. So Headway is a great resource and the Headway support groups are a great resource, but people felt that this specific difficulty of cognitive communication difficulties wasn't necessarily covered in the kind of general support groups. So perhaps a specific support group that would focus on the kind of cognitive communication difficulties, families felt like that would be really useful as well.
Yeah.
And that's an interesting thing, I suppose, because we often say no to brain injuries are the same and no to cognitive communication difficulty presentation is the same. Yeah. So I suppose that makes sense that people want bespoke information. But equally, they want to be able to link in with other people that are perhaps sharing information or going through a similar experience. That seems to be kind of one of the themes that kind of came through around accessing family support groups or having a range of information that they can tap into.
Following on from this questionnaire, we then did a second project that's hopefully going to be out in brain injury in the next week or two. And that was a focus group study where we actually got family members to come in and give us more detail really about what they would like and when they would like it and how it would be. And, you know, a peer support group came up a lot within these family members, not just within the first year, but family members that are maybe 4 or 5 years post-injury. They were saying a support group. And what was coming out was that cognitive communication difficulties can sometimes be quite subtle. And to the wider family or to friends, people might not be aware of them. So the person supporting the person following brain injury, the family member supporting the person following brain injury, can often feel a bit guilty talking about these difficulties because other people aren't seeing them. And can also feel like they're in it alone and a bit lonely because it's not like, you know, a right-sided weakness that everybody can see. And I think they feel just being able to speak to other people that have got experience of loved ones with cognitive communication difficulties would be really useful. That's what was coming out from the second project that we did.
I think one of the themes that kind of crops up, we've kind of touched on it, but maybe not labelled it as such, but just that kind of shift in the sense of self, both for the person who's had the brain injury, if they've maybe got awareness of how things have changed and what that means for their communication, but also for the family member who has maybe had to change their role in the dynamics of the relationships. So I think that maybe ties in a bit, doesn't it, to the peer support aspect that you're talking about there.
That's so absolutely right, Helen.
Adjustment and changes in roles. I think in terms of brain injury services, we need to think more about that and make sure that we are delivering those sorts of supports for people. I think we're very good at going in and being gung-ho with the old physio and speech therapy and doing rehabilitation.
Impairment,
and I think it's also about, like you were saying, living well and developing a new life and an adjustment to the things that have happened. And that's what's difficult.
Yeah, and that was something that, you know, when we were talking about timeframes, like the follow-up appointment at a year, I'm thinking, oh my goodness, you know, this person or family have gone through a major, still in grief, and they're getting their follow-up appointment, which is kind of the landmark for that's it, you're done. There's no way they're ready for being done.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. Anyway, so where does this take us, Lynn? You know, you've already talked about the further research, so
I think
coming out.
This was just a wee dip in the water. So there's so much other research that can be done with family members. So we do need more in-depth information about what families would like and how we can help them. And I think future studies really need to use families and the individual following a brain injury, you know, as joint experts. The people following brain injury and the family members should be helping the professionals co-design what it is that they want. So instead of us just designing a communication partner training program, wouldn't it be nice that we actually got the family members and the individuals following brain injury involved so that, you know, we're delivering what it is that would be helpful and what they would like. So I think it's...
And that makes so much sense, doesn't it? But maybe in reality, that doesn't often happen.
Oh, I know. And I think it's just about us being aware that the person following brain injury and the family member, they are equal partners with the professionals in this sort of journey to a new life and a new role and new happiness. So it's about recognising them as experts.
I think it's going to take, you know, it's going to take time for us, and that's okay. We'll be kind to ourselves, you know. It's a change, isn't it? Away from that impairment focus to a more participation focus, you know. But, you know, it not only is it going to take time for us to change, but we're going to need the time to do it. But I guess if we're not focusing on impairment and we're focusing on participation, taking that time away from impairment and moving it to participation, but you know, I think there's a bit of an expectation for us to be actively working on impairment, and so it's not just us that needs to change, it's everybody, you know, needs to see it differently.
I think it's something that certainly working with you, Lynn, and hearing about your research as it's progressed, you know, I think it's maybe fair to say that we've perhaps both started to make some changes in our approach and trying to do a bit more of the kind of participation aspect. And I think obviously the people we're working with now would never have known what our previous approach would have been, but I think there's been positive feedback, hasn't there, from people saying, oh, that's actually really helpful to have had that information or had that conversation just to understand, to explain to someone what cognitive communication actually means, because most people have never even heard of these two words put together.
And that's what we've found whenever we've done training with members of staff within hospitals or social work staff. You know, all the feedback is like, oh, I didn't know that cognitive communication difficulties existed. That was very interesting. So, you know, I think it is about speech and language therapists training the general public up about cognitive communication difficulties as well.
Yeah.
And just having people be more accepting and more able to recognise these difficulties.
Well, I know when I did my training with Sheila McDonald back in 2012, that was what she was saying even then, you know, you need to use the words cognitive communication disorder, you know, so that you do sort of educate people about it. So, Lynn, before we finish, is there anything that, you know, would be your take home message for us? If we went into work tomorrow and changed one thing, or started changing one thing, because it takes time, what do you
think? You know me as a speech therapist, it's really hard to just say one thing.
Yeah.
I think I've got three things that I'll say really quickly.
Top three, okay.
So I think, first of all, the person following TBI and their family need time to adjust and develop awareness of their cognitive communication difficulties. And services required to be sensitive to this. And the information, training and support needs need to be available for over the longer term and not just in the sort of short, acute time span. And I think the nature of this information, training and support needs to be co-designed by the person following, because they are the real experts. So we need to get from them what it is that we could do to be the most helpful. So I think that's my take home. That wasn't too long, was it?
Yeah, not at all. No,
that wasn't too long. Yeah. That was, yes, we really appreciate your time.
Absolutely.
And your knowledge.
And I think it's worth just noting the fact that Lynn has managed to conduct this research at the same time as continuing with a clinical caseload. So I think we all take our hats off to you for managing to do that.
Raising the profile of speech and language therapy.
Worry.
Thank you,
absolutely.
Lynn.
I've really enjoyed it. And it's just to say that, you know, that the research isn't perfect and there are weaknesses in the research, but I think it's just about just having a go and you know, and just
have
as a start, because lots of research is coming out from Australia, and there's no reason why, you know, we can't be doing some research too with a bit of support from the experts.
Well, thank you, Lynn, for giving up your time again to talk to us. We have really enjoyed speaking to you and taking part in that conversation. I'm sure those of you listening to it will have enjoyed it too. If you have listened to this and want to keep the conversation about family support going, head online, perhaps tag us on Twitter at BrainySLT or on Instagram at BrainySpeechTherapists. Thanks for listening. Until next time, cheerio.
Bye.
Cheerio.